Well, if you'd like to grab a seat, make yourselves comfortable.
We've spread it out so that you don't have to go right to the far corners, but keep fairly close, as we are smaller in number than we perhaps hoped. My name's Robert, I'm the minister at Park United Reformed Church and the URC chaplain to the university. Mark Lane Smith, many of you will know, is the full-time Anglican chaplain at the university. And Adam here at the front is from Fair Trade Foundation. He's been with the foundation for 4 years, having been there as an intern, and also worked for Christian Aid as an intern. So full of experiences of this kind of work, and is currently the Communities Campaigns Manager, and comes to us with a brand new report, the Smallholders Report and Project, and he's going to share with us. We're one of the very first groups he shared this new report with, so it's all quite new, not just for us, but also for Adam. So you are guinea pigs, apparently. But I'm sure you'll be very, very helpful guinea pigs for this evening. So thank you for coming along and supporting. There's loads of literature, and I'm sure we'll hear more. And if you want to know anything, there's going to be a discussion time a couple of times, we say. We're going to break it up. So there'll be a couple of points for asking questions. So keep your questions and then fire them at Adam, not me, because he knows far more than I do about this. But it's just great to welcome you all here this evening. And I'm going to pass straight on to Adam.
Okay, thanks Rob. Thank you for coming, it's great to be here. It's fairly intimate, so I hope you don't mind if I sit down. I have to operate this keyboard to move the slides on, so I think it'd be easier that way, if that's alright with you. Brief thanks for the introduction, Rob. That's right, I'm Communities Campaigns Manager, which means that at the Foundation I sit in the campaigns team. There's six or seven of us at the moment within the team, and our role is to support the UK public, or specifically the 0.1% of the UK public who campaign for fair trade, not just sort of buying fair trade, but taking action in their communities to raise the issues behind fair trade. So I coordinate the Fair Trade Towns scheme and Fair Trade Faith scheme, so fair trade churches and synagogues, fair trade towns, boroughs, counties, islands, etc. So that's my day job. I'm not a policy buff, but have been involved at various stages of developing this campaign and have been across our interaction with Enough If as well, which I'll also talk about. So as I say, I'm going to talk a bit about the Enough If campaign, where the Fair Trade Foundation sits in. I'd like to just give a brief update on the fair trade generally as well. I know that I don't need to go over what fair trade is all about with you all, but I'll just give you a few updates and then introduce to you the Make Food Fair campaign, which has launched just this week. So this is the first time that I've been out speaking about the campaign, so there might be a little bit more reading than I would like, but please bear with me. So firstly, in terms of the fair trade updates, it was announced this week that the sales of fair trade products in the UK eclipsed £1.5 billion at retail value in 2011, which is actually a 19% increase on the spend of 2010, which is brilliant news, and it's more than we were expecting, I think, in the current times. And I'm not going to dwell too long on all of those numbers, but rather sort of talk about what that actually means. So this graph just shows over the last few years the growth in the number of producer groups who are certified as fair trade, so therefore benefiting by selling their products on fair trade terms. So there are now 1.24 million farmers and workers involved in these producer organisations, spread across 66 different countries. And actually this graph only goes up to 2010, but we're now just shy of 1,000 different producer organisations around the world. I'm not expecting you to read all these numbers, but I just wanted to illustrate briefly how they're spread across the world. I sometimes hear fair trade is just supporting Latin American coffee farmers where they have minimum wages. It's not strictly true. I'll just read out the numbers for you. Of those 1.24 million, 663,000 of them are based in Africa and the Middle East. There are 285,000 in Latin America and the Caribbean, and 122,000, so less still in Asia and Oceania. So just to very quickly recap on what the fair trade actually means, it's most known for guaranteeing a stable price, the fair trade minimum price for producers, giving them a safety net so that when world prices drop below this, which is based on a sustainable cost of production, they know that they can still cover their costs. On top of this, there's an additional premium which suppliers pay to producer organisations. This is aggregated across the organisation and then is up to all the producers to democratically decide how they wish to invest that. Fair trade standards are quite stringent, and they include environmental standards, for example. So GM seeds are banned as part of fair trade standards. There are elements, depending on the product, to do with better use of water. The worst pesticides are banned from being used. So there are standards that producer groups have to adhere to. And ultimately, the organisation which comes through this gives producers a stronger position on world markets. And in terms of the closer link between shoppers and producers, I'll come back to that shortly. So what it means in terms of a guaranteed minimum price, it gives the stability for producers to invest, to earn enough to cover today and to feel a bit more secure about tomorrow. These are just some of the examples of how producer groups have invested their money. Their premium money. These are from the Windward Islands, where banana farmers, is often said there would be no banana industry anymore in the Windwards were it not for fair trade. And the I won't go into it in detail, but the range of health and educational and social projects they've invested in are really, really impressive. Yeah.
Sorry, can you just explain what a producer group is?
Sure, yes. A producer group is the organisation which farmers or workers belong to. So fair trade works largely, mostly with smallholder farmers. It's about three quarters of all of those producers. And they are formed into cooperatives. So a cooperative is a producer group. But I say producer group rather than cooperative because fair trade also works in certain commodities where appropriate with hired labour on larger scale farms. So where the standards work a bit differently, but they would still be, so they're not a cooperative, but they would be a producer group. I mentioned the environment, and it's sometimes forgotten because fair trade is very well known for the minimum price and premium, but the environmental standards are a key part of fair trade, and I think it's just over 50% of fair trade producers are also organic, for example. I think we've covered that. So this is all great, I hope you agree, but a lot of the benefits of fair trade and why I think it's so unique and so strong is a little bit more intangible. It's the link that it brings about between consumers and producers and civil society and campaigners, which creates the noise to try and change the way that business operates and show governments that consumers care. And it's this kind of unique partnership which is going to be even more relevant to the campaign which I'm talking about, because fair trade sales growing is brilliant, and there's now 1.24 million farmers and workers involved. But as we all know, there are many, many hundreds of millions of farmers out there, many of whom are going hungry, as we're going to talk about tonight. So we have a long, long way to go. And I think that the real power of fair trade is getting these issues on the table and actually raising awareness. There are so many kids coming through school now learning about fair trade, which didn't even happen even when I was at school, which wasn't that long ago. So I think it's creating an environment for a fairer society and raising these issues in a way which haven't been before. So at that point, I would just invite you to ask any questions just about fair trade generally before we sort of take it on to the next step.
Yeah. Sorry, are there any fair trade fishermen?
There aren't, no. There have been some investigations, so when we're interested in developing new fair trade products, Then there's quite a long process which has to be undertaken, scoping out what the issues are in that commodity, what fair trade standards might need to address, and that's done in consultation with other NGOs, existing producer organisations, to find out what is a sustainable cost of production, for example, what are the issues in this industry, is it completely plagued by child labour, is it the use of pesticides which are destroying the environment. So it's a long process that goes through, and there have been some investigations into some types of seafood, but nothing which has come to market.
Adam, do you know where the growth has taken place? Because it's quite interesting, anecdotally, in the supermarket, I'm seeing less on the shelves, places like Asda and Tesco's. So, interesting to see that the figures are actually showing a rise overall of sales of fair trade goods. So, any idea where that's taking place?
Yes, well, chocolate is a big one. There's the sales of chocolate, cocoa and sugar have been a large part of that rise, and a lot of that is down to people like Mars switching their Maltesers brand to fair trade, and a few of the other big chocolate companies over the last year. Wine has been growing. Wine has grown over the last year. Most things like coffee has held steady over the past few years. So it's those products really where most of the growth is coming from. Certainly sugar generally through the chocolate, and also ever since Tate and Lyle switched really 5 or 6 years ago, has been a big growth product.
How do bankers and people in the stock markets, I'm sure, indulge in chocolate and wine and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Okay. But they speculate on food prices.
Yeah.
Which impacts third world countries.
Yeah.
Massively. Does fair trade get involved in supporting the anti-food speculation campaign?
We have supported WDM's food speculation campaign. It will be a part of what I talk about later, actually. So if it's okay, I might park it for now, and we will come back to it. But yeah, there are things to say there, certainly. Yeah.
Going back to the, you had a slide with a map of the world. I'm not sure whether I just need to clear my glasses, but were you saying that around about 40 or 50% of workers are actually fair trade workers within those countries? Is that what figures mean?
No.
On the Africa one and the Asia one, at least.
No, it doesn't. No,
okay.
It means that of all of the fair trade producers in Africa, 41% of them. Actually, I'm not too sure what that means. I have to get back to you on that.
I thought it was rather a large figure. So
yeah, but no, it's not 41% of all workers.
41% of the global.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well spotted.
Okay.
Can I ask about what's happening about banana production? Because I believe that one time, a year or two back, the big American corporations, is it Del Monte and people like that, were sort of trying to. Was it taking the European Union to the WTO on the basis that giving preferential terms to small producers like the Wilmot Islands was quote-unquote anti-competitive? Can you update us on that? What happened? I don't know what happened.
Well, I'm a bit rusty on this, but as I understand, they did take the EU to court and they did win. So they ruled that it was unfair for Caribbean farmers to receive preferential treatments. So that's bad news, actually, for banana production by small-scale producers in the Windward Islands, certainly, and they will be suffering as a result. I think it's going to phase in, so it hasn't happened yet, and the worst of the effects haven't been seen, so it will phase in over years. And there's another, the question that remains to be answered, I think, is what the EU is going to do about that, because there have been measures proposed to support those economies. So the governments of the Windward Islands have been promised compensation or some kind of aid to recompense. But what's not clear is how that's going to filter down to all of the smallholder farmers who depend on bananas for their livelihoods.
We may in fact be witnessing a slow motion car crash without industry because the big American producers might.
Well, I think it's fair to say that banana production in the Caribbean and places like the Windwards has already, I think there's probably a tenth of the number of banana farmers still operating in the Windwards compared on 15, 20 years ago. The damage has already been done largely. They've really suffered over the last couple of decades. And this is just another blow. So they're already struggling and this could be the blow which ends banana exports from the Windwards. But yeah. No, it's a serious situation. I don't know the latest, but I can certainly send an update through. So that takes me on to Make Food Fair. So what do we know? We know that the food system is broken. It's not working for consumers, I would say, and it certainly isn't working for producers either. So in industrialized nations, we actually throw away as much food every year as the entire production of sub-Saharan Africa, which is pretty shocking, really. Obesity is a growing concern, and a recent World Health Organization study showed that for the first time, the number of years of life lost, of healthy living lost due to obesity, is actually greater than the number of years of life lost through not eating enough. So, and we've had various, it was a couple of months ago now that milk farmers in the UK were blocking the gates of the processing plants. You might remember seeing that in the news, and it's the plight of UK farmers has been highlighted over the last few years. They're getting a raw deal as well. They're suffering some of the same challenges as farmers around the world. And what have our burgers taught us? I don't think I need to tell you what that's referring to. But today, a colleague of mine came into the office with a copy of The Sun today, which doesn't happen very often in our office. But it was because he'd seen on the train on the way in that in The Sun today, Tesco had taken out a two-page advert, which looked like this, from Tesco, called What Burgers Have Taught Us. And fortunately, they also printed it in The Standard, so I didn't have to buy The Sun on the way over here. But it's a really marked change in the tone of anything Tesco has said before, sort of acknowledging that they need to go a lot further to sort out the food system, acknowledging that the food industry is broken and that there's more they need to do, and they want to hear from consumers about it. So I'll leave this here and we can come back to it later. But if they've been taking these out in the national papers, I think it shows the seriousness of where we are with our whole food system. So businesses are out of touch with their supply chains. We've had Horsegate, as I said, and Farmergate is already happening. It could be just around the corner. So we need to start valuing the food that we eat and also the people who grow it. So in short, we need to make food fair. So what I'm about to talk about largely comes from this report, Powering Up Smallholder Farmers to Make Food Fair, which I actually had a handful ready to bring to me, and I left them in the office, but you can get it online and I can send you a copy. So
actually, would you be ever so kind just to pass that around if people can get to it?
Of course. So we're talking about powering up smallholders, so let's start with what is a smallholder. So a smallholder, it encompasses a wide range of producers, from the most marginal and impoverished subsistence farmers to those who have some engagement to some extent with local markets or international markets. To give it some context, around 17 out of 20 of all the world's farms are under 2 hectares in size. So the majority of farmers out there are smallholder farmers. But here's the scandal. Although they produce around 70% of the planet's foods, they also represent 50% of the world's hungry, the hungriest people in the world. I think it was estimated something approaching 900 million people living in hunger, and half of those are these smallholder farmers themselves who are growing the food, putting food on the world's plate, which is a scandal, I think. So Fairtrade's experience, and where we're coming to this, is of working with around 1,000 producer organisations, many smallholders around the world, and learning and Fairtrade as a development tool for empowering communities to change their situation. And we've learnt a few things along the way, things that go well, things that don't go well, and the impact that smallholders, when you unleash the power of smallholders, the impact that they can have for sustainable development. And I should say as well that our experience mostly is in cash crops and farmers growing crops for export. So that's mostly what I'm talking about here. So imagine a world without cocoa and chocolate, and imagine a world without coffee. I could probably live without chocolate, but I couldn't live without coffee, personally. But when you consider that over 90% of the world's cocoa is grown by smallholders on around 5 million farms, and that by extension there are 40 to 50 million people in the world whose livelihoods depend on the production of cocoa, you can see that it's a possibility if we don't invest in sustainable agriculture, if we don't pay a fair price. With coffee, this is also largely produced by smallholders. Around 80% of the world's coffee is grown by smallholders. That's around 25 million farmers. And so there are around 100 million people in the world whose livelihoods depend on growing coffee. Tea is largely grown on plantations, but in some countries, say Kenya for example, there are actually 3 million livelihoods where it's grown as small holdings. There are 3 million people whose livelihoods depend on growing tea. In Sri Lanka, 76% of their tea exports are grown by smallholders, and that represents actually 5% of the world's tea production. Bananas as well, another fair trade, key fair trade commodity. Although around 90% of international trade in bananas is now coming from plantations, in many other countries, places like the Philippines and across Africa, they're still largely grown by smallholders. We're not just concerned about farming for feeding our plates here, we're concerned with the whole picture of smallholder farmers. Sugar is, again, mainly grown on plantations, but there are also many, many smallholders involved, and it's in some countries it's dominated by smallholders, sugar production. So we should face up to the reality that if we don't value the people who grow our food, then we may have to learn to live without it. And I think some businesses are starting to wake up to this. But I don't know that everyone here is going to be motivated by the thought of not having chocolate. Let's think about the reality of what this means for farmers themselves. And you can imagine the process leading up to not being able to afford to grow cocoa isn't a pleasant one. It's not a case of somebody deciding, I'm not making money anymore, I'll stop and I'll set up an internet cafe in rural Ghana. It's a case of continuing to strive to grow enough cocoa, trying to grow more, trying to cut corners, perhaps using different fertilizers, using seeds given by an unscrupulous company to try and increase productivity. It's not going to be a pretty way to get to that situation. But I think it's worth saying, and particularly as advocates and as campaigners, to say that a crisis for someone in the food system is a crisis for us all. But what I want to talk about really is the power of smallholders. And by this I mean, why are smallholders so important to feeding the world and also to economic and social development for the world and to alleviating poverty? Well, there are three main reasons. One is the role that smallholders can play in poverty reduction and economic growth. So there's plenty of evidence to show that smallholders are really, really effective at driving local growth, growth in GDP and economic development, even more so than large-scale plantations. And that's because they're tapped into local markets. Income comes in through families and communities from fair trade and the organisation of producer smallholder cooperatives. We've seen the way through the social premium that the extra money coming in is invested in a democratic way for the benefit of communities. So the fair trade system demonstrates this, but it's also outside. We don't have to just look at the fair trade system. Two of the countries who have lifted the most people out of poverty in recent years, China and Vietnam. In China, 200 million people have been lifted out of poverty, and that's not through large-scale agriculture, but in rural areas through empowering smallholder farmers who typically farm under a hectare plot. The other key role that smallholders play, a bit like farmers in this country, is environmental stewardship. So smallholders look after many of the world's natural resources, like land, water, forests, and they, in many cases, have done so for generations, and they understand it. But also, they have an incentive to keep protecting it, because that's the future of the household income for them. The other thing I wanted to touch on, and related to this picture, which I quite like, is the role of women in farming and in smallholders. So women produce 60 to 80% of the food in most developing countries. And actually, they're the main farmers of staple foods. So women produce around 90% of staple foods, maize, corn, rice, etc., which is consumed by the rural poor in developing countries. So they have a crucial role to play, and we have to be very targeted and specific about the role that women play.
Be clear about what you're saying. You're saying that women are overwhelmingly the predominant farmers when it comes to non-cash crops, in other words, the food crops that people use, whereas by implication, presumably, it's the blokes who are producing the cash crops. Is it that simple?
Probably not. I think that women also very much involved in the cash crops as well.
Things like, presumably, cocoa and so on are cash crops.
Yeah.
You can't eat cocoa, you have to trade it to buy food.
Yeah. I think it's also a question of land ownership and who is seen as producing. But we will come back to the role of women as well, certainly. However, and this isn't a direct comparison with those previous stats I've said, but women control around 2% of land globally, despite the overwhelming contribution that they make. But Fairtrade's experience does show a glimpse of the power of smallholders when they're organised, when they're empowered, and when they're paid fairly. Smallholder agriculture has suffered from decades of underinvestment because of the increased emphasis on large-scale plantations to try and drive efficiency and productivity, which I think now businesses and governments are coming back on and realising starting to realise the role that smallholders play. But we do need urgent and targeted action in order to unleash that power. These sacks, by the way, that the ladies are carrying, this is an image from Uganda and coffee farmers, and they weigh about 60 kilograms, I'm told, these sacks. So I couldn't lift 60 kilograms, let alone carry it on my back. So when we talk about the power of smallholders physically, but also in a metaphorical sense. So, in terms of, let's turn to some of the challenges which smallholders are facing. And firstly is influence. So, too often smallholders, the demands that they have for inputs, go unheard. They don't have the influence on policy decisions which affect them. They generally lack a voice in decision making. Both commercially, they don't have the power as smallholders to negotiate contracts with traders or large corporations. When they come together and organise, they have a bit more of a chance. So these are a couple of examples from the Windward Islands where WINFA, the fair trade organisation of banana farmers of the islands has actually started to take control more and come together, where all of the all bananas leaving the islands now are fair trade certified, and this has given the farmers a much stronger position to negotiate contracts. They've taken ownership of what was previously a government run business that they all had to sell their bananas to for export. They now own that business, so the supply of bananas from the farm to export is entirely controlled by the farmers' organisation. And there are many, many, many examples of the organisation brought around by cooperatives, as we see on the right. Even if it's a case of buying scales that they know haven't been tampered with, so that when it comes to weighing a bag of coffee, the producers know that they're being paid a fair price. It can even be as simple as that. Another challenge.
Are they challenged by cartels and local groups like that control, who the farmers of that contract are?
Again, I might touch on this in a bit, but certainly I think still the majority of smallholders have to sell to local traders, who they don't have any connection with sort of the next level on. We will come back to the role that sort of traders play in this as well. But
these are middlemen.
The middlemen, yeah. Well, climate change, I don't need to explain what this is, and I think I probably don't need to explain the severe impact that it's having on farming around the world. It's affecting producer farmers right now, smallholders right now, seriously. So numerous studies have shown that yields from rain-fed agriculture are going to fall by as much as 50% between now and 2050. Seasons are affected, rainfall becomes less predictable, productivity is already going down for coffee producers, for example, across Africa. This image here was taken, it doesn't come out so well, but there's heavy rain coming down. This was taken as well from St. Lucia in the Windward Islands, where they've been devastated by a series of hurricanes over the last few years. Now, they've always had hurricanes, but they seem to be becoming more frequent and more intense. And in the last 5 years, there's been Hurricane Thomas, Hurricane Dean, which have, Hurricane Thomas, the last one, virtually wiped out the entire production of bananas on the islands and forced them to start from scratch. So these, the weather patterns and climate change, global warming is also increasing the incidence of pests and diseases affecting certainly banana farmers in the Windward Islands as well. It's just a completely new expression of unfairness and inequality, because these are the people who have done the very, very least to cause it. So we talked a bit about food prices, and what I said that we supported WDM's campaign around food speculation, and partly because we're not experts. There are others who are experts in this, but we do agree with the position that speculation on world food markets is harming smallholder producers. And this shows, for example, how volatile prices can be, and this shows the price for coffee over the past 20 years. And you can see it a number of times has dropped below. This light blue line is the fair trade minimum price, 140 cents a pound, which increased slightly in 2007, and some of the different spikes and the peaks that have happened. Volatile prices make it really hard for smallholders to plan, to know how much to plant, to know where to invest, and to guarantee to them that they'll actually be able to recover their costs at the end of the season. Food prices, they're mainly based on the international exchange markets based in London and New York, so smallholders have very little control over this. They take the price which is dictated, and actually any increase in price rarely makes it back down to the smallholders because of these middlemen, and smallholders will very rarely have access to what the latest market price will be. In any case, the majority of smallholder farmers are actually net food importers, which means they buy more food than they produce, than they sell. So when food prices go up, they don't see the benefits of that because they're paying more for their inputs, and that is the food that they consume, but also fuel, which has been going up, and fertilizers and other things. So there are, of course, many other challenges. We talked a bit about the important role that smallholders play in environmental stewardship, and often it's very hard for them to the legal situation with land tenure is very tenuous, if I can say that, across many parts of the world. Access to water is an issue. The access to markets, particularly for those growing cash crops, some who've been encouraged by third parties to diversify into cash crops and then don't have the access to markets. Also just access to basic skills, tools, technology and agricultural services. There are very little provision of extension workers in country to support smallholders. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that the amount of grain lost after harvest in sub-Saharan Africa amounts to about $4 billion a year, which is nearly a seventh of the total production. So that's because of a lack of technology, and it's grain lost after harvest because of a lack of skills and the correct tools. So they haven't had, as I say, the correct level of investment over the past couple of decades. Many farmers don't have access to credit. Businesses in this country, by and large, can get loans. You can get access to credit when needed. That's a typical business model. Smallholders are business people too. But it's very hard for them to access credit. But also, with all of the other challenges that we've been mentioned, there's a real dilemma for a smallholder as whether they want to take credit. Because if food prices are volatile, and you might not actually, and they may drop by 50% by the time you've grown your cocoa, why would you take the risk of borrowing in order to plant if you may end up getting in debt and getting in a spiral of debt? I imagine you're probably all aware of the damaging effects of subsidies in rich countries. So a couple of years ago, one of the last reports that we released, the Great Cotton Stitch-Up, shows the wall of subsidies that the US and China and the EU actually pay to cotton farmers. In the US, I think it's something like $47 billion over the last 10 years has been paid to subsidize cotton production. And this isn't paying cotton farmers, this is paying big agribusiness to farm huge farms with huge amounts of pesticides, highly mechanized. And it produces far more cotton than is needed, which is then dumped on world markets. So cotton producers in West Africa are having a really, really tough time at the moment. And the price that they are then forced to accept for their cotton is way below the sustainable cost of production. And finally, a note about corporate control of the food system. So we've touched on it a bit earlier, and we've heard a bit about traders. Obviously, the big and the powerful businesses set the rules by which trade takes place. They set, by and large, the prices and the standards to which producers have to meet. So they're set by a few powerful organisations and companies. So they can, in setting up the way the system works, they shift the costs and the risks to be borne by others, by producers, and I would perhaps say by consumers as well, actually. To illustrate this, in the coffee industry, there were just three companies: Nestlé, Kraft, and Demaster Blender / Dow Egberts, which account for 42% of all global coffee sales. In the cocoa industry, there are four companies: Kraft, Mars, Nestlé, and Ferrero, which account for 56% of world chocolate sales. in total $82.5 billion. In the tea industry, there are 7 vertically integrated tea companies which control about 85% of all tea production through their own factories and estates which they own. And bananas, as we mentioned, there are just 5 companies, Chiquita, Dole, Del Monte, Noboa and Fifes, which control around 3/4 of the world banana trade. So it just...
When you say bananas, you may not know, is that specifically sweet dessert bananas, or does it include plantain, which is a kind of banana, except it's used as a kind of like a starch potato
equivalent?
Yeah. Are you presuming you just sweet bananas that we use in the West?
Yeah, this only refers to internationally traded bananas, and I know plantain is traded because I buy it in all the corner shops around me in Walthamstow. Yeah, this is. I think that's a small percentage. Yeah. So anyway, summing up, there are a huge range of challenges which are posed specifically to smallholder farmers, and all of these, as I mentioned, affect women. It's a thread that runs all the way through. And looking at Africa, for example, women own just 1% of the land. Of all the extension services and support to agriculture, they receive only 7%, and they receive just 1% of credit, agricultural credit, despite, as we talked about earlier, and as it says in the report you may have seen, producing 60 to 80% of production. But what are the solutions? I'm not just here to talk about all of the problems, and the report isn't just there to talk about problems, but actually to propose some solutions. So the report suggests a 5-point agenda, and this is based on what we have learnt through fair trade over the last few decades, and but how we think business and government needs to go further to support smallholders, not just using the fair trade mark, not just converting to the fair trade mark, but let's look a bit wider than this. So firstly is putting farmers first and increasing farmers' voice, because once farmers have a voice, they have more influence and more control over the decisions which affect them. Because underlying all of these challenges is a lack of power. Governments and donors too often fail to listen to the voices and the insights that smallholder farmers have when they're considering policy and trade negotiations. And recent attempts that I mentioned of business to increase the emphasis on and improve productivity in smallholders tend to be very top-down approaches rather than empowering smallholders themselves to come up with solutions. But Fairtrade's experience shows that when smallholders are organised, have control over their resources and influence over the decisions that affect them, the results are impressive. This is actually an image from St Lucia, one of my favourite places. Not that I've been there, I'd love to go one day. This is a meeting of representatives of the banana farmers organisation, WINFA, with the Minister of Agriculture. So actually by being organised, now they're in the room with government, with the minister, taking decisions on the government's agricultural policy. The second point of the 5-point agenda is a fair share of value. Government and business need to ensure that farmers are empowered in value chains and receive fair prices. So as we talked about the corporate control of the food system, it squeezes down the prices which farmers receive. But governments have a real role to play to make this work and to enable smallholders to receive a sustainable price. But more than this, typically in tea, smallholders receive under 3% of the final retail value of the tea that they produce, under 3%. The rest is taken out along the way and by retailers. This image here is from the Iriani Tea Organisation in Kenya, where they've actually taken some further steps, and thanks to support and investment actually Marks and Spencers have been quite involved in this. They now have their own packaging factory, so they're growing and developing and processing tea and packaging it at source, so they're capturing a lot more of the value of their product and exporting it this way. This is something that you do see cropping up around the fair trade system, but it does rely on businesses actually supporting this kind of production, because as we talked about with tea, these vertically integrated companies, when they own all the different steps of the process, this isn't really something that they necessarily want or support. The third point is fair access to finance. So it's crucial for smallholders to have access to credit when they need it to invest. Fairtrade enables that already by providing them with access to pre-financing. So as part of the Fairtrade standards, producers can request up to 60% of the value of their contract at the start of the season from the supplier. And also, organised cooperatives, they're more creditworthy to attract finance from other places, like banks or agricultural lending schemes. But there are a lot more innovations that are needed to make this the norm, and innovations in lending practices are urgently needed to do this. The image here is from the Choche coffee-growing community in Oromia in Ethiopia, the home of coffee. And the reason I bring this up is because a fair trade campaigner that I know through my involvement in fair trade from the Keswick Fair Trade Town Group came and presented a little while back about an initiative that they had in Keswick, where they developed a friendship link with the Choche community in Ethiopia. And they got to know them as coffee growers, and they found, they asked, what's the biggest problem that you have? And it was that all the coffee farmers were in debt because they didn't receive enough for their coffee, so they ended up getting in more in debt every season from the traders who they would be selling their coffee to. So through the Rotary Club, actually, up in the Lake District, forming a link with the Rotary Club in Ethiopia, they set up a microfinance and lending scheme to try and break this cycle of debt and be able to provide finance to the smallholder coffee farmers. So it's a nice example of how this can happen. This was a grassroots thing, but this should be business norm. Smallholders aren't just, they're not a basket case, as I say, they're business people. They need to be paid a fair price, that's all. They already invest around $170 billion a year in their own farms, smallholders globally. According to a UN report, I believe. So, but there's more investment that's needed. So it's not a case of them being just recipients. They need support as business people. The fourth point is around future-proof farming. So prioritising sustainable agriculture and climate resilience. As we talked about the impending effects of climate change and global warming for producers, sustainable agriculture has to be a priority, and business needs to invest in this, and in terms of adapting to the effects of climate change, but also finding new ways for smallholders and producers to produce in more sustainable ways. So I've put up, this is not a very glamorous picture, it's not very artistic, it's just quite simply a coffee roasting oven from Costa Rica. And this is something which the fair trade cooperative had invested in with their fair trade premium to, and it's actually run, they actually burn it not with wood. The coffee was previously roasted by wood fires, which has to have somebody staying up all night actually keeping the wood topped up, and if you fall asleep then it gets very cold and then it gets very hot, and the coffee that you get out at the end isn't very good quality. But this one actually is powered by macadamia nut shells. So across the island in Costa Rica there was another producer organisation growing macadamia nuts, and they had all these shells, they had nothing to do with them, they were thrown away. So they're actually now used to power their oven. It's just one example of a more sustainable way of doing business. So the final of the 5 points is a focus in government funding. So everything I've talked about here is really about a better way of doing business. But I know this is about enough food for all, and this is really where I'd like to make the link, to say that government funding and aid really does have a role to play in this. There needs to be more of it, and it needs to be properly targeted to these areas that we've talked about, targeted to supporting women, for example. It's been suggested that if women simply had the same access to productive resources such as land and seed as men, that they could increase yields on their farms by as much as 25% to 30%. This is the kind of thing, this is the kind of way which donors need to target their aid. So there needs to be more aid, but it needs to be better as well. And I'd just like to click on this.
For attending. First on the agenda today is world hunger.
I hate this problem.
Me too.
1 in 8 people in the world are hungry, and they shouldn't be, so we do need to solve this.
That sounds like a really, really big problem.
Sounds like it's almost impossible to solve.
It is too complicated.
We have tried it before. We never get anywhere.
Well, is there anything that we can do?
Well, I have to say, guys, I don't think we're going to crack this one today.
Maybe we should tackle this one after some lunch.
Great, I'm starving.
It's got to be a mistake. I do apologise. Seems like we've had a bit of a problem here.
The world produces enough food for everyone, yet 1 in 8 people in the world are hungry.
Thank you, sir.
It's a problem that can be solved. There can be enough food for everyone if the G8 takes action.
So it is possible. There can be enough food for everyone.
I think he's onto something.
Sign up to help put hunger on the table at the G8 in 2013. And please, share this film.
So I just saw that today and thought it was quite good. It was just launched today by the Enough If campaign. What if the G8 were kids? And it's a good point to end on, really, for two reasons. Partly because, as I'm sure you're all aware, the Enough If campaign has been launched, and one of the angles is increased and better aid. And everything I've just talked about is something which the Enough campaign is calling for. But I guess the Make Food Fair campaign, which the Fair Trade Foundation has launched, is going into more detail, because this is the area where we have some experience, and we would like to say something. So the main action for this campaign that's been launched is also targeted at the G8. We're asking David Cameron to adopt this 5-point plan the eyes of the world are going to be on the UK and on the G8 in June when they meet. The Enough campaign is going to be shining the spotlight. It's going to be holding David Cameron to account and pushing the four policy asks of the Enough campaign that I won't repeat again for you. And we're also saying that in terms of aid and that it needs to be targeted towards smallholders. So we're encouraging David Cameron to adopt this five-point plan and to really champion the role of smallholders in the discussions at the G8 as a part of the big focus on hunger and ending hunger, which, as we've seen, can be done. And hopefully with some of these steps taken, will be done. So, it's Fair Trade Fortnight, and this campaign has just been launched. And in order to get this on the agenda of David Cameron, we are having a march in Parliament Square next week, but to ask David Cameron to adopt this five-point agenda. But you don't have to come down. All you have to do is log on to fairtrade.org.uk/gofurther and click on Join the March to sign up to the petition pushing the five-point plan to David Cameron. And as a result, you will be able to create a little version of you, which we will then take down to Parliament Square next Thursday, which will create a precedent and be able to launch the campaign and get it on David Cameron's agenda. So please sign up, please encourage others. We're almost at 5,000 marchers already. Another dozen would be great, so please share. This will feed into the policy asks of the Enough If campaign around the G8 in hopefully quite a seamless way. So that's about all I had to say about Make Food Fair. I hope it made sense. As I said, it's the first time I've tried to ramble on through this. And I'm not a policy boffin, but I've been involved in various points along the way, so it'd be good to have a discussion about this, or Enough, or any angle that strikes you, really. And if there are things, tricky questions, I hope there are, and I hope there are some that I can't answer, and I can go back and find answers and send them out to you. So, can we just open it up to discussion? Yeah.
David Cameron, I think, is probably put his eye in the right place anyway. I mean, it's going to be like pushing it over and we're asking him to do this.
Mm.
But what support is there, what campaign is going on in the rest of the world that the other people from the G8, the other leaders of the G8, will be aware of?
That's a very good question, and the first question is a tricky one, which is good. I don't know what is going on in other countries around this. I know certainly the Enough If coalition is making a big noise in the UK and is bringing together many organisations and supporters. I'm not really on top of what's happening in other countries, to be honest. So, to be honest, I can't really answer that. I think that David Cameron is the host. We hope we'll be able to push this, and this is where, as UK citizens, we can target our energy. I think it's a good question, and I'm not too sure of the answer, to be honest. So I can try and find out, and it's one I think generally for the Enough coalition to think about, actually.
It makes perfect sense to have some sort of coordination that's going on between
Yeah, I haven't heard of too much other engagement in the G8 meeting from other countries, to be honest. But no, it does make sense.
Specifically with the RCF campaign,
yeah.
I think it's been quite and it's just been launched, so I'll be interested to know what's our strategy going forward.
That's another good question. So I suppose our involvement in we are part of the Fair Trade Foundation is a part of the Enough coalition. So at the moment, I think that the film that I just showed is starting to build momentum towards the G8. There are the four policy asks which people have been asked to promote to their MPs, to speak to David Cameron and to get on his agenda. And this is something that we're supporting, there are various lifestyle asks as a part of the Enough campaign. So, for example, I mentioned that the rich world wastes as much food as sub-Saharan Africa produces. So one of the actions is for people is to reduce waste. Another one is to buy fair trade. And I haven't been as involved in the Enough strategy, the Enough coalition strategy, I'm not too sure of the exact next steps. But it's I think it's largely being delivered through the organisations who are a part. And because from our point of view, we know that fair trade supporters are also Christine Aid supporters, and they're Oxfam supporters, and they're CAFOD supporters. We haven't got a specific Enough If plan. But Rob, do you have more on that?
There's a couple of things coming up. One of the things is the budget coming up. So the campaign is focusing on pressurising George Osborne to stick to the 0.7 of GDP for international aid. And apparently we're being asked to approach our MPs because there is pressure under this current economic climate. There is pressure from some areas within Parliament not to commit to that 0.7. So we've finally got a government that says they will commit to the 0.7% for international aid. So we want them to actually stick to that. So one of the things that we're doing locally is meeting with Rob Wilson, and that will be next Friday. We've booked him with his cancer surgery next Friday at 4:15. So if anyone's available, come along. If you're a Reading East resident, 4:15 at Woodley Library, Woodley Library.
Sorry, what day is that?
That's Friday, I think it's the 5th of March, right? Friday, 4:15 is Rob Wilson. Is it 8th?
It's the 8th of March.
It's the 8th. Is that the Friday? As long as it's the Friday, that's the 19th. So that's to talk specifically about the 0.7. And then I think the next build-up will be the June gathering of G8. So that's when the four pushes will be made. It's really getting the G8 leaders to sign up to make some changes. And that's about the tax evasion, tax avoidance, and making that whole area more transparent, along with other things. So I think we'll see a lot more as we build up towards the G8 time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not clear, although I've been talking with Miranda, St John, and others, I'm not clear about what the follow-up is after the G8. It seems to me that that's the big build-up, and we'll be pushing. And it's largely going to be through politicians, so our MPs, Chancellor, the PM, to make sure that they've got that clear message that there is public support, and this is an issue that we want seen through. I guess it always depends. Whenever the G8 seem to meet, it depends on what other world crisis is happening at the same time. And so often these really important issues for us are kind of pushed down the agenda because something else much bigger is seen to be in the way. But I do hope this year we might get that impact. And I think that's one of the strengths of the coalition. I remember when I first signed up, there were about 60 organisations involved. Now it's over 100. And, with so many NGOs behind this, it was a bigger catchment. Certainly, going back to the campaigning with the MPs, Rachel's from Reading West, that's right, isn't it? We've tried to book a time with Alok Sharma, but he's not available, so there's a number of us that are writing to Alok in Reading West. And of course, John Redwood, some of us are living Lower Early and so on, that's John Redwood's area. The church down at St Nick's Church in Early, I've arranged to meet with him. Put some pressure on there. So they're kind of galvanising our different action groups and putting that into place. So that's the two dates I know about. It's the March focusing on the budget and 0.7%, and then the June GA thing. And I think we'll be, you know, if you keep going back to the website, we'll be keeping us up to date on what actions to take. So the Enough Food If website is well worth checking out.
Didn't Alok and Rob sign a pledge or something for the Launch the If campaign?
They were both there, they both signed, yes. And said some good words as well. I spoke to both of them, Salim and I were both at the launch. I spoke to Alok, was particularly interested in the tax dodging and making that whole area more transparent. So he's well behind the campaign in that respect. Rob was taking more of the food waste angle. I mean, you know, he's also encouraging locally in the local community that we get together and pick apples from trees and so on and make jams. So he was very much more locally focused. Don't think he's got such an awareness of the bigger issues. But he was saying all the right things. I think the next step is making sure they follow through. And when they come to vote, it'll be interesting to see how they what they actually say in Parliament and so on. I find that Rob's always very good for a Photoshop and saying the right thing. I apologise if any of you are family members. So, any other questions for Adam or Beth?
I have a few questions on your 5-point strategy. And I should tell you in advance that I'm one of the advisors from the Ministry of Agriculture in China. So
oh, right.
When we're looking at the fair trade system, which is very much supporting cash crops, if we're looking at food hunger, I would very much like to see within fair trade that you're encouraging farmers, yes, to have their cash crop, but also to be diversifying, because if we're going to have a sustainable position where they can feed themselves, there ought not to be quite so much emphasis on growing a single crop and then everyone around is growing the same crop, whether it's going to be the equivalent of Dutch elm disease or coffee unknown virus coming through. Sooner or later, that is going to get devastated by some pest and disease. And it seems to me that one is encouraging them to put everything into this one activity, and that that's not a sustainable form of agriculture, and it is not resilient to climate change, and it's fundamentally flawed right down to the bottom, because the risk is we get the coffee and they go extremely hungry in the future. And I would like to see that change in the system somehow.
Okay.
I accept that it's not the policy sort of move, but it's the effect that this has. The second thing is actually your detailed requirement on smallholders. My experience working in China is the absolute worst people for never wanting to change anything.
Okay.
We've
always done it this way. We've got loads of neighbours who've always done it this way. So even if I am listening to the advice given, everyone around me will convince me it's wrong. So I can see on smallholder areas in China big problems with pests and diseases which are tackled with the wrong pesticide and far too much pesticide or the wrong whatever it is. The quantity of pesticides, the quantity of really appalling food quality that's coming into the shops in China is really worrying. So that people who've got enough money are actually now saying, I'm only feeding my children on things that are imported from abroad because I don't trust anything that's grown in this country.
Yes.
So that just saying that smallholders are close to the ground and therefore a good thing, my experience is that is just wrong.
Okay.
Because although in theory you ought to be able to get hold of them and they ought to be interested in making change, and China has a TV station broadcasting on agriculture. There are 4 new programs every day going out to the community on agricultural techniques, on things that need to be changed, on on how to work together as cooperatives to get a better price. There are some successes, I'm not saying it's entirely, but it is incredibly hard to change that bottom level. And actually what I'm seeing in agriculture in China is the changes are taking place in the medium-sized and larger-sized farmers. Mm. They're the ones who are taking the message that you don't need as much fertilizer or pesticide to do this. They're the ones who are open to change. Because they've got time to listen, because they've got, you know, it's just that problem of how you get anyone from that position to slightly above it is much harder than the one who's got that little bit of spare time or their children have gone to school, and it's just easier for them to make that change. So I'm not convinced that just targeting the smallholders is the way forward. And also when you're hungry, you don't care what happens to the land. It's all very well to say, well, you're protecting it for your kids, but you need food now. If that means you dig it up and ruin the soil quality and everything else, well, that's what you do, because you need to survive. So it doesn't feel a realistic message to me.
Okay. No, well, thanks for the contributions. There's an expert in the room. I think on the diversification point, I totally agree, and it might sound as if it's encouraging more and more sole cash crop planting. That's not really what fair trade would encourage, certainly. And there are many, many examples of, in order to diversify as a smallholder, you need to have a basic income and some way to invest. So hopefully what fair trade is doing, and like I said, lots of examples of this, is giving people the money to invest, to diversify. Going back to the Windward Islands, there are some great stories from where they have to diversify, partly because they can't sell they can't guarantee that they'll be able to sell their bananas forever.
You're saying the banana industry has shrunk enormously, so what do the farmers do now? What's
being grown? Many banana farms are not being used. People are unemployed, people have gone into other areas to try and find work. But what they have done as well, the WINFA, the farmers organisation, have invested in, for example, a processing plant for the other fruits which they grow locally, the other products, so that they can be turned into jams and juices and things, and those are sold locally. There's lots of examples of farmers growing, diversifying into other crops and using the stability brought to them through the fair trade minimum price, and in order to be able to do this. In terms of the fair trade premium payment, I was looking at a report the other day. I think it's around about 50% of the extra premium payments which are paid to producer organisations, and then they then decide how to spend that. Around 50% is spent in improving business, improving their capacity as businesses. So it is it's a way of enabling investment. I take the point that it needs to be explicit and there needs to be more. And I do hope that the fair trade system does encourage that diversification and not reliance on one product. In terms of the other points, smallholders, I totally agree. When you're hungry, your priority is to feed your family, and other concerns can drop down the priority list. I think altogether, in terms of organising people together, is probably hopefully the starting point towards trying to get knowledge and skills out there. But I wonder if there are other...
I can only say to you that China is really proud of the number of cooperatives they have.
Okay.
They have millions of them.
Yeah.
Their education system is not just national television. They have 10,000 different local points where farmers can go in, and if they don't have their own television, see their television programs. And of those, about 1,000 of them are interactive, so you can go to those studios and you can talk to an expert in real time that's talking about what the programme has been, and they also have outreach workers. But because the number, once you're talking about a small holding which is less than a hectare, the actual number of people you're trying to get hold of is so huge that, that you can throw huge investment in it and huge resources in it, and you've made no difference at all. Because unless you can find the way, I mean, I would say that the problem is that they do it across the country, and what they should do is say, I know it's unfair, but actually we're going to put all of our resources into this small part of Jiangsu province, because once we've got, you need to convert the group, not small numbers of people within the group.
Yeah.
Because actually, when you have a really small holding, what you do on that little piece of land has no impact on the wider amount around. So unless everybody in the area is thinking in terms of different ways of irrigation, different ways of pest control, you can't do it on your own because you're not big enough to start to make a change, and therefore you can't show your neighbour that it's worth doing because there's no visible evidence that the change has happened. So it's that really saying we're not going to be fair about this. The change and the aid has to be small area by small area, and a real, that's where the investment goes in change, that's where the training goes in change. But that seems to be something very difficult for development aid to do, because they like to be fair and say, well, you know, it's spread across the country, and we need to go to someone. I don't think there's a lot of evidence of that working. Maybe on a small island, yes, and on one crop, but not if you're really trying to change hearts and minds. And if I can make one other point.
Yeah.
There was a big research program across Europe on barley over the last 2-3 years, which was looking at something very important, which was trying to make a genetic diverse strain of seed where you could send out to farmers and be relatively certain that no matter what the changing weather conditions would be this year, a reasonable proportion would actually produce you a crop. So to completely take away from the current system, which is really getting down to a genetically similar seed strain, which will of course give you the maximum yield in a perfect weather condition year and with the right amount of fertilizer at the right time, but is completely useless for a time when climate is changing and you might have more drought conditions this year and more wet conditions next year. So that kind of mindset and that kind of research, particularly for people who are going to be only growing coffee, the worst thing is that they're only growing this strain of coffee, and over the years it gets more and more genetically similar and all the diversity is bred out because it gives you the perfect seed which goes through the processor properly, and now we've got industrial systems, so it's even more important we don't have small grains or ones with a bubble on the end, or, you know. And that again, if we're looking at climate resilience, is hugely important thing for, I think, to go with the fair trade system.
Great, thanks. Lots for me to take back. Thank you.
And I was just going to add, you did strike that one of the difficulties might be the scale at which farmers are operating, that it might be in their interest to grow a little bigger. I don't mean turn them into massive, mega industrial farms, but sort of to operate at a larger scale and sort of encourage people not to just have their own little patch, but to actually have you do try and encourage co-operatives, but where actually the whole land holding is, actively encourage them to scale up a little bit to a level where, you know, economic scales of production,
what's the word, economies of scale start to I mean, part of the problem is that, of course, that farming isn't in itself a thing on its own in isolation. It is actually an integral part of the society of the people who are the farmers.
Mm.
So the way that land tenure operates, the way that the small, you know, it reflects values and traditions in the society, and it's, you know, it's not easy to, I mean, you can't just tell people to do it differently. I mean, they have to choose to do it differently. What I'm saying is that simply paying a floor price or having a fair trade system, it may need to be a little bit more sophisticated, but I don't know, maybe you're doing that, but I don't know, maybe there's more that goes on than you've told us, I don't know.
Well, there certainly is more than I've told you going on, and I probably don't know the extent of it even. I think that certainly organisation, cooperatives, and producer is the bedrock of it, and bringing people together.
So they, in effect, although individually they may be only small parcels of land, they are in effect operating as a large scale enterprise, even larger scale enterprise, even if the individual piece of land are owned by a large number of individuals. They're adopting similar policies and practices and gaining a collective benefit from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of negotiating a better price, and some cooperatives, for example, may have 50 members, and others, some of the larger ones, have got 70,000. They operate in very different ways, but yes, and the whole idea is to be organised. It's a cooperative which is registered and certified as fair trade, all the sharing of the skills and experiences is a part of that, as well as the sort of power of joint bargaining in the market. Yeah.
At the cooperative level,
yeah. Obviously. Yeah. But I'm interested in what you think about the other thing about expanding, and there's interesting points that you make about the challenges of working with smallholders, which probably weren't covered in here. And if there is something from China which can be learnt about where the success has been in.
Work.
Oh, okay, right.
That's one of the things the Ministry of Agriculture in China is really keen to work out, how to persuade all these smallholders to be more environmental.
Okay.
They have an entire institute, which is the group I work with, on agro-environmental protection, which is the main institute advising the ministry. It's a mega problem. The government has acknowledged that there is an issue and these things need to be solved. And they've got an entire organisation that does education of farmers. The structure would seem to be in place to enable this to happen, but there really aren't examples of it being terribly successful.
Mm.
We've got sort of some demonstration farms that work, but those have got enormous input of money and resources to actually make it work, and then normally linked to a university where you've got the students have gone through some sort of coursework first, but it's a different kind of farmer to the ones on the ground in the vast, vast rural areas that no one ever gets to almost. So the changes that you see happening, the changes that have happened, are actually in what I would call the sort of educated East Coast, which is on the slightly larger farms, and where they've got links with universities, and there's some organic farms starting, but very few. And you can see in China the split between producer and consumer getting wider and wider, in the same way as in the West. And trying to think up a policy at the moment to try and get that back together, rather than just the consumer saying we distrust everything that the farmer produces, which isn't terribly helpful either.
Mm.
I mean, that may be the same as horse meat, but one doesn't need that kind of attitude.
Mm.
Okay. So I don't have any suggestions.
Yet. Okay.
If I come up with anything useful that works, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Yeah, some of those changes take a generation. It is about educating a whole new way of approaching things and allowing those people to be their only advocates. So, thank you very much.
I think fair trade's approach is through standards, basically, and by imposing imposing standards on producers. And each fair trade fortnight, we have some producer visitors come to the UK, and I was speaking with one from Costa Rica, that picture of the oven is actually his, and the way it's interesting the way he talks about fair trade, because they come here and they tell us to do this, but actually afterwards we saw that it was better. So I think it's a certain amount of saying you need to do this to access this market. That's okay for accessing world markets, but I suppose and there are nice examples and case studies where producers have operated in a different way, but yeah, this is certain. It's a very small percent.
How you spread that out over the vast majority.
Yeah, and we can't certify the world, so.
No.
I'm right in thinking there is fair trade gold as well, isn't there?
Mm.
Last year, I think, about that.
Okay.
Because that has many similarities to small scale farm production, that there are loads and loads of tiny gold miners. Small-scale gold mines. It's very similar to the food market, but you've got a very large number of people producing quite a lot of the gold, and a small number of large corporations producing a smaller quantity of it. But we know about the big corporations, not about the small-scale miners, and they end up using dreadful chemicals and expose themselves to dreadful risks.
The latest sort of interesting new development in fair trade is fair trade and fair mines gold. So the standards were developed with an organisation called the Alliance for Responsible Mining and other organisations based in Latin America, and it's specifically for artisanal miners. I don't have the stats to my fingers actually on this. In terms of the proportion of world production that comes from artisans, but it was identified as a need, and is growing quite well actually. It's a difficult one to grow fair trade and fair mine gold, because it's one of those products a bit like cotton, where because the market price is that much lower than what a sustainable the fair trade minimum price, it's that much more expensive for companies to do it, and I think gold is one of those. So to do, and also because the quantities are so small, you can only really buy fair trade, fair mine gold in quite expensive pieces at the moment, and it's not yet. And gold is something which not everyone wants to buy gold. Not everybody can buy gold. It's not an everyday purchase like a banana, so it's a different type of product, but does seem to be growing.
Jacobs, who has actually used some fair trade gold and has got products.
Okay. And I think Ernest Jones is the first high street retailer to do some. Yeah.
Thank you. Can we express our gratefulness to Adam for coming down to speak to us? And I think our guinea pigs have certainly tested you out with a number of questions.
It's been great.
As smallholders, but we look forward to hearing more about the campaign and to hear how it develops. Thank you again for coming down during Fair Trade Fortnight. It must be a busy fortnight for you and the rest of the office. We're delighted to be able to support it. As a Fair Trade University and Reading being a Fair Trade town, if only we could get such success in working it. Thank you. And thank you all for coming. If you want to keep in touch, then by all means pass me your email addresses if you want any more details about your email. And there's these ones out, which are for fair trade, obviously. So these ones go back to Adam's office in London. So if you're more than welcome to take any of those, or just hang around and talk for a bit longer if you wish. Can I just ask, do you work at the university?
I work at the university.
With whom are you part of, sir? Should I say?
I'm part of, I mean, I sell meat.
Excellent.
Come on, you're a consultant.
You're a horse meat consultant. No.
A horse trader.
Right. Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming. It's been great to see you. You just put the word around about the IF campaign. There'll be more going around. If any of you could use a banner for your church, I have some banners with me. I don't think John took one, did he? Well, did you see John take a banner?
I didn't. Or Trinity?
So if you'd like. You are a Trinity, aren't you? So there's a couple outside. And I've got one for you to take, Mark, for St. John's.
Yep, okay.